From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour, a recent conversation I had with Alan Potash of the Anti-Defamation League. He'll tell us about a recent resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa. Potash says today's white supremacist sects are exploiting a stagnant economy, the immigration debate, and gay marriage to recruit members and spread their message of racial and religious division. Then in the second half hour, my conversation with former skinhead gang leader Frank Meek, now of Des Moines. He'll tell us about his descent into America's Nazi underground. He'll give a public lecture this evening at Iowa State University. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we look at intolerance and extremism in Iowa. Later in the hour, a conversation with the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, Alan Potash, who will tell us about increased Ku Klux Klan activity in the state. Potash says the Klan has a renewed energy with increased recruitment in Iowa. He points to growing disenchantment with immigration laws and the legalization of same-sex marriage in Iowa as reasons for increased KKK activity. That's coming up later on in The Exchange. But first, my conversation with Frank Meek. Meek is a former skinhead gang member who grew up on the streets of West Philadelphia. By age 16, he was a skinhead gang leader on the East Coast. And by age 18, he was in prison in Illinois. While there, he began to question his hatred, largely because of his African-American teammates on a prison football league team. Meek left the white supremacy movement after being paroled, and he eventually moved to Iowa, where he is the founder of the Hockey Harmony Foundation, which encourages youth of all races to play hockey. Meek is the author of the new book, Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. He'll speak tonight at Iowa State University in the Memorial Sunroom. The lecture is sponsored by ISU's Center for the Study of Violence. I spoke with Frank Meek last week and began by asking him what led him to the path of becoming a skinhead.
Well, I grew up with the typical single mother trying to make it. I struggled a lot. And, you know, I've really had a lot of pride in that sometimes. And then my mom, she had some boyfriends off and on throughout my life. Some I liked, some I didn't like. Some were alcoholics, some weren't. And finally, I went away to camp one year, and I came back. I was probably about 10, and there was a man in my house. And I was always known throughout the family. It was I was the man of the house, even though I was 10. And I really didn't mind having other men around. I thought it would always be good to have a father figure. I barely seen my real father at all. And this guy comes down the steps, and he starts talking with me, and he says, I'm going to be moving in here. You know, me and your mother really hit it off. And I said, well, when are you going to move in? And he said, I'm already in. He already moved in on us. So, mm-hmm. And I was fine with it. And then he started making these, rules that, they're rules that everyone would follow anyway. No disrespectful, don't be disrespectful to your mother, and no talking back. And I was fine with that because I wasn't that type of kid anyway. I was never one of those kids that said, I hate you or no. You know, if my mom told me to do something, I might not do it right away or I would hesitate. But I never said, no, I'm not doing that. And so I figured it was an easy rule to apply in my life with this new man in my house. And to him, disrespectful meant if I didn't jump up and do what she said right away, if I rolled my eyes when someone told me to do something, stuff that a kid does.
So it was a zero tolerance policy, so to speak.
Zero, absolute zero. And even if I did achieve it, it still was never good enough. Mm-hmm. And even my mom now will back that up, that the guy was just brutal to me, brutal. And so now he's moving, and I'm trying to go to school, and I'm not the greatest kid at school. I'm not the smartest kid. And doing homework was every night was just torture because he would call me down and make me stand in front of him. And if I didn't put a period where I was supposed to or a comma where I was supposed to, I was an idiot and I was dumb. And he doesn't see me doing anything besides doing what my real father does, which was be a bartender, And he would always say these things to me. And then the hitting started getting a little bit more. The ground being punished was just all the time. And punishments were in my room, no TV, know nothing. I can't talk on the phone. I'm allowed to come down and eat dinner with the family, but I can't talk at the dinner table because an idiot like me is just going to ruin dinner. So don't talk. And then I go back up to my room. Now, the only thing I used to do was I would hide a little black and white TV under a pile of dirty clothes. And the only time I would ever risk watching it was when the Philadelphia Flyers were on, which was like the hockey team in Philly. I grew up right next to the stadium. Just, you know, it's like people with the Red Sox. I mean, Philly is a big Flyers, Eagles town. And so I would just sneak and watch the games. And other than that, I keep the dirty clothes on top of my TV. Well, sometimes when I would come home and my mom wasn't around, he would get a little bit more physical with me. And finally, one day, I got suspended from school for fighting, and I went home, and I didn't know that they knew yet. So I walked in the house. He's standing behind the wall where I can't see him. And as I walk in, he just sucker punches me and almost knocks me out. Like, I was kind of out for a second on my feet, and he just jumped on me and beat me pretty good that night and drug me up to my room and tried to hit me with my lamp, my old ET lamp. Well, he tried to hit me with it. And he said, why don't you pack your stuff? You're going to move out of here. And he said, you're going to move with your father. Well, I went to my dad's house, and my dad lives up in Southwest Philadelphia, and that's also close to West Philly. And you guys all know West Philly, born and raised on the playground where I spent most of my days. Mm-hmm. Well, it's mostly all black up in that neck of the woods. And I went to an all-black school, and the white kids, there's maybe about 20 white males that went to school there with me. It's called Pepper Middle School. And the white kids just got tormented all the time. I mean, it was just a daily game. We would get off the trolleys together, me and the other kids, the other white kids, and one kid would just say, all right, on your mark, set, go. And all of us, as fast as we could, would run from the trolley stop to school, because right in between our school and the trolley stop was the projects. So we'd try to run the school, and I was always fast. I was always good at sports, so I was always like one of the first kids at school, which you're a little bit more safer when you got to school, but then when you got to school, you just had to always, there was always tension, there was always someone saying something, you were always being degraded, and the teachers and a lot of the faculty were from the local area and were also black and knew a lot of the black kids and their families and stuff, so it kind of was always just like, oh, don't do that, but they didn't like really stop it from happening. It was horrible. It was absolute horrible place to go to school. I mean, yeah, I talked to other people that went to school there now still, and they'll say, yeah, it was hell. That was hell on earth going to school every day. So that summer I graduated, even though I cut the last 40 something days of school because I just got tired of going to school there. They still graduated me. I was, mm-hmm. you know, just the whole last semester I missed, and they just said, well, you're old enough to go to high school. So they put me in high school. Well, that summer I went up to my cousin's house up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where it's all Amish and horse and buggies. And my family that was up there, it's my mom's side of the family. They're originally from South Philly, so I was real close with them. And it was just so different. It was like National Geographic to go up there and see cows and pigs. And, you know, in our neighborhood, we have one squirrel, and we chase that one squirrel, like, every day, that poor thing, you know. So now it's just abundance everywhere, and I loved it. My cousin was a skateboarder, and I kind of was a skateboarder the whole time and really was into it. And when I went up to go visit him, again, a kid who I looked up to in the skateboarding and the punk rock scene, he wasn't a skateboarder or punk rock anymore. He was a skinhead. So every night he would have all these other skinheads come over, you know, two, three, four sometimes come over his house, and they climb up in his back window. He had like a little balcony and a little door. It was a nice house my aunt and uncle had. So anyway, they climb up in there, and they would always bring beer, and sometimes they bring girls over, and they'd all drink and talk about multiracial society will never work. I have no clue. I'm 13, going on 14 years old. I have no clue what that means. But once they start talking about how blacks and whites don't get along, I say, yeah, I know that. And then they would start saying, that's right, you went to school in Philly. What's it? Philly to them was like a mystical city, you know. None of them have ever, they're all farm boys mostly, you know. Mm-hmm. So that they'd be like, what's it really like growing up there? And I'm like, well, going to school was hell every day. And every night they would start to drink and they'd give me a couple beers. I'm like the little guy of the group. And like, what's it again, you know, what's it like going to school there? And every night, to me, now that I look back on it, as the person I am today, I look back on it. And that was them. That was someone finally in my life saying, how was your day? How was school? Did you learn anything? Like, because my parents never asked me any of them questions. I was a burden my whole life to them. So now these people are actually asking me, how's your life? So I enjoyed hanging out with them. Mm-hmm. And then one night I finally went to a concert with them, and I still had a little skateboarder haircut. And my cousin said in front of all the other skinheads, he said, well, how about this? you stay against the wall because there's going to be a lot of fights tonight. And some of the skinheads didn't know me that were at this place. And he said, so you stay over there so no one beats you up accidentally because we're just going to beat up everybody with hair. Well, big skinhead said, no, I got him. And he put me on his shoulders and he went into this dance pit, this mosh pit, and started beating on this one guy. And we grabbed him and said, Frank, kick him. So now I'm on this big guy's shoulders kicking this guy in the face. And the bouncers came, kicked us out. We went outside and we waited for all the other skinheads to get kicked out that whole night. And I'll never forget, we went back up to my cousin's room and that bigger skinhead slapped me in my head and said, when are you going to shave this crap off your head, meaning my hair? And I said, I looked at my cousin and said, I would love to do it. And my cousin said, go ahead, do it. So they took me out back on the little back porch, and each guy that was there that night took the clippers and did one row of my hair for me.
And you were part of it.
That was it.
You were part of it. So past getting in fights, beating up people with hair, what is the vision of this group? Or did it even go that far? How things should be in the U.S., in your community, in Lancaster or Philly, that isn't that way now?
Well, the early on when I'm first getting in, the whole image and the look and the wanting to belong was just that. They all looked the same. I like that. I remember watching them all stand against the wall together. And they all looked the same. And to be honest, that first time when I was kicking that guy in the face and we waited outside to see if that guy had anything to say to us afterwards, it felt so good to be on that end of finally the whoopings, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that part is what got me in. There was no yet talk of race war stuff. It was when I first started to learn about the skinheads, all they wanted me to learn was what National Socialism is, what communism is, what left wing, right wing is, and stuff that I already – I mean, that was interesting to me anyway, you know? So, because of course, when I first see a picture of Hitler, and I knew both my great-grandfathers fought in the big war, at first I think of evil, you know? So these guys had to take that away and take it back and say, no, you know, he had the right vision, and we were all duped by the Jews to fight in the war, and that's where the doctrine starts coming in.
So as you got further into the group and eventually became a gang leader, what sort of violence did you commit? How many acts of violence a week?
It's uncountable. You know, by the end, I would honestly say 300-400 acts of violence. And some of that was also put on me. Now, I put myself in that situation where other groups of people wanted to get at us because we were neo-Nazis. There's communist skinheads out there. There's a group called SHARP, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. And then there's other gangs that don't like us neither. So we would, you know, get jumped too. But violence is just all the time. That's what we live for. That's our camaraderie. We don't go out and shoot basketballs together. We don't go shoot hockey pucks together. We go out and we either, you know, can jump homeless people like Clockwork Orange, if you ever see the movie.
Sure.
I mean, we do these things and we do it because it's our camaraderie.
How did you justify that in your own head?
Oh, they were all enemies of the white race. If you were homeless, no matter what color you were destroying the white race. If we thought you were gay, that was good enough. I mean, you didn't, you know, someone just say he's gay and we'd be in a mob and it's mob mentality and we would roll somebody. That was just what we did. That was actually one of my first arrests was for a gay bashing.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Frank Meek, the former neo-Nazi skinhead gang leader, speaks tonight at Iowa State University. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now let's get back to my conversation with former skinhead gang leader Frank Meek. I spoke with Meek last week and asked him what led to his arrest and eventual imprisonment in Illinois.
No, I got sentenced to 3 years and only did a year and a couple months. My conviction was for aggravated kidnapping, aggravated unlawful restraint. And by that time, I had moved out to Illinois because I had a bunch of warrants for my arrest in Philadelphia and Delaware and New Jersey and the little tri-state area I come from. So I was living in Springfield, Illinois, and there was this one kind of communist, Sharpie skinhead that kind of hung around with us. Me and my roommate, we both had different problems with them, but we both didn't like them. So we invited him over and we kidnapped him.
You kidnapped him?
Yes.
What was your goal?
Just to torture him and humiliate him as much as possible. We had talked about killing him, but we knew we weren't going to take it that far. It wasn't, you know, and talking if I was back then, to us at the time, it wasn't worth it. So he had owed us something, and we wanted it.
And you beat him and videotaped it.
Yeah, we videotaped it to show all of our new recruits because we had really got a big crew going in Springfield at the time, which was, you know, and this is where people say how I was a good recruiter, and this is documented by Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League. From me back then, they wrote about how I was good at getting people into this. I used to have my own cable access show to recruit skinheads in Springfield, Illinois. So our movement had moved up. So we had a lot of new recruits, and we kind of wanted to just show them this video as a joke. And
so as a good recruiter, what is the key to getting a new recruit? Who do you know is a good potential skinhead?
What started was I would go to a high school, and we'd already have a skinhead or one of our friends in that high school. And we go and we hang out with him. And now you got to remember, I'm only 17 at the time, so I'm basically a high school kid myself.
Right.
But I'm just have tattoos everywhere, you know, a big swastika on my neck and all that. But we'd hang outside of school, and he'd come out, and eventually his friends that he kind of hung and went to elementary school or whatever would start coming out and hanging out with him, and they thought we were cool. And you got to say, they were mostly all like the skateboarders and punk rock kids, just like I was, and, you know, the goth kids and the alternative kids. And that's how we started in Illinois, and that's how it got really big real quick.
In prison, you began to question your hatred, your vision of life. What changed in prison? What did you encounter in prison that made you start to question this?
For one, I started going to this Bible studies group. And I wasn't going to Bible studies because I was really willing to turn my life and, you know, everything over to a higher power. I was like, please, God, help me out of this court case. You know, that's the only reason why I was going to Bible studies. And so were all the other guys, but they just happened to be all black dudes. So sometimes some of the black kids and some of the Latino guys would go out and play football and basketball a lot, and we played soccer once in a while. And I would just go out and I would play with these guys because I wanted the competition. And when these black kids would first see me come out to come play, they see this skinhead, and they say, come on, you really don't want to play. And I say, no, I want to play. And they say, all right, well, you can do kickoff returns, knowing no one's going to block for me. And, you know, people are going to miss their assignments on that
right.
play. So so these guys start, like, laying into me. But the first kickoff return I get, I do these little spin moves, and I'm reversing the ball in the corner of my arms and holding it, and I run the ball back. And it's because no one expected it from me. So after that, of course, all the kids on my sub block kind of always be like, hey, you know, you want to play? We're going to play again, you know, next Sunday or whatever. And I noticed these were all the kids that were my age. You know, we were all 17-year-old kids doing adult prison times, 18-year-old kids. So we'd always talk about the same thing, like whenever we were done playing sports, always. And it was the only time we got to do this with each other, really, was we'd always talk about girls. Because you can't talk about your girls to your older inmates. It just... You know, they're doing 15 to life, and you start talking about your girlfriend. When you get out, she's waiting for you, and they would tell you that she's not waiting for you, and they'd be very, very graphic in what she's doing with your friends right now while you're in here. So I hated hearing that from them, obviously. And they did it to be funny older guys and trying to show me the ropes. Well, I didn't want to hear that. I had a daughter on the way, and so did one of the other guys I played football with. So we'd always just talk about that. And I remember this one time I got a letter. And it was kind of almost a breakup letter in prison. And I wasn't the best boyfriend. I was a horrible boyfriend. So the mother of my daughter didn't need to step away from me. Well, I had to bring it to this black kid I played football with and said, hey, can I read this letter? Because I don't comprehend it. And I read him this letter, and she wrote, I love you. And we were both like, man, she still says she loves you. Like, I shared the most intimate part with a guy who related more to me. So,
and he had a different skin color.
Different skin color. Just he had the same exact situation going on at home that I did.
After 3 years, you got released, and I believe this is in 1995, there was the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Right.
A turning point for you. Why?
I knew people that wanted to do that, and I'll honestly say I was one of them. I thought when you read the Turner Diaries and you read about the movement, this is what you want. This is the end result. You want to start a race war with the federal government. And I seen it finally in action. And I seen there's a picture that will be burned in my brain forever. And that's the fireman running down the street with that little girl in his arm. Now, I'd already been out of the movement now when this happened. Like, I'd already walked away from it because there was a Jewish man who hired me. There was just the higher power really started stepping in my life and slapping me in the head every time I tried to judge. Like, he really, that happened. He would come up and something would happen and it would just say, look how wrong you are. So now I'm starting to admit I'm wrong, but I'm going to leave it at that. All right. And let me walk away from it. But when Oklahoma City happened, there was this feeling of I'm evil still to my core. And I never felt that before. I always felt evil on the outside. Even as a skinhead, I felt big and bad, but I felt like I was a good guy inside. And I'm out of it, but I still, now I'm feeling the evil on the inside. So I went to the feds.
I know the image you're talking about. Is it the fireman with a little baby or a little girl
in
his arms?
The little girl. Yeah, and she's all burned on the side of her
head.
You'd
seen so much violence. Why did that one touch you?
Because I hadn't seen my daughter in a long time, I think. Because I had moved away. I moved back to Philly, and me and her mother didn't work things out. And I think I always wanted to be loved. And here's a little girl that would probably love me for life if I got to see her more. And here I don't see her. And here, because of beliefs I had, now someone's daughter is taken from them.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Frank Mink. He is a former neo-Nazi skinhead. He's going to discuss his descent into America's Nazi underground and his ultimate triumph over hatred and addiction during a talk at Iowa State University. He is the author of The Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. You're the founder of Harmony Through Hockey Foundation. What is that?
Harmony Through Hockey is a foundation I started in the late 90s. Where we were in some of the tougher neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and I thought, what, hockey's a huge love of mine. I mean, it's just a sport that I love, and I've really seen when I was in prison, I played sports with people, and we put everything to the side, and we didn't have any gear on. You could see who you're playing with, and you just wanted to win. Well, I thought if we took some of these kids in the rougher neighborhoods in Philly, mixed them all up, put hockey gear on them, you can't see the little soggy hockey kid in there. All you see is the color of the jersey, and you just want to play and have fun. And it was kind of easy, and it started off, and then it just grew. And 98, we had two more rinks, and then 99, we got another rink. So we had, like, all together, we had, like, 200-and-something kids in our program. And it would be 20 at a time in each rink. So I moved to Iowa. Like, it was just something that was going to happen, so I moved to Iowa. And I wanted to start it again, and then there was the Iowa Stars here that were the Dallas Stars affiliate, who knew I was here, and one day just called me out of the blue and said, hey, are you looking to still do your hockey program and be involved with the organization? And so I said, sure. And I go in and I pitch the idea to them, and they loved it. And I started it here in Iowa. And
so as a former neo-Nazi skinhead from the East, from Philadelphia, moving to Iowa, we have no big cities like Philadelphia, really. Is the nature of racism different here at all, or is it basically the same thing?
Oh, racism is always the same thing. It is us, them. Us first, them, and for some reason, I'm better than or worse than because of the color of my skin. That's all racism is. It's pretty simple.
Did you find how was it different though? Was there a lesser degree of racism or that
no,
too the same?
It's all the same here. It's all the same everywhere in the world.
No less than Philly.
Absolutely not, because it's all a personal, individual decision. That I'm better or worse than because of the, or God, you know, and even have some people to think God loves them more because of the color of their skin. I mean, racism will always be the same.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Frank Mink. This has been an incredible conversation. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I want to thank you for having this conversation.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Former neo-Nazi skinhead and gang leader Frank Mink is the author of the new book, Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Mink will speak tonight at Iowa State University in the Memorial Sunroom. The lecture is sponsored by ISU's Center for the Study of Violence. Coming up after a short break, a conversation with Alan Potash, the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Potash says the Ku Klux Klan is seeing a resurgence in Iowa. He says Klan members are exploiting a stagnant economy, the immigration debate, and gay marriage to recruit. That's when we come back with more of The Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So glad you could join us over the noon hour. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we talk about Buddhism in the West and in Iowa. Later this spring, the Dalai Lama is scheduled to visit the state. So tomorrow we'll look at the origins of Buddhism and how it has been adapted to Western culture. My guests will include Stephen Asma of Columbia College in Chicago. He's the author of Why I Am a Buddhist, No-Nonsense Buddhism with Red Meat and Whiskey. Also on tomorrow's program, David Grubin, director of the upcoming PBS program, The Buddha, narrated by Richard Gere. Also, Suzanne Friedman, Associate Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of Northern Iowa, will join us. She'll discuss the Dalai Lama's perspective on forgiveness. That's tomorrow, Wednesday, on the noon hour of The Exchange. But now we continue this hour's discussion about intolerance and extremism in our state. Alan Potash is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Potash says his organization is seeing increased Ku Klux Klan activity in Iowa. He says the Klan has a renewed energy with increased recruitment in Iowa. He points to growing disenchantment with immigration laws and the legalization of same-sex marriage in Iowa as reasons for increased KKK activity. I spoke with Alan Potash yesterday and asked about the nature of the KKK resurgence in Iowa.
Well, I would say it started in about 2005, 2006, when we started to see an increase of activity and also the demonstrating of some of the people who consider themselves part of the Klan. Recently, well, starting in 2006, around the country, we have seen a resurgence of activity. In Iowa specifically, we started to see pamphleting and promoting and recruiting done in parking lots around central Iowa, where we would get phone calls from shopping center managers saying, you know, we've discovered flyers on top of windshields. We're, you know, asking people to come and learn and be a part of the Ku Klux Klan. So that started in about 2006. And then with issues in Iowa, we started to see an individual kind of take charge, in a sense, Douglas Sadler, who has not really shied away from the media. He started demonstrating in Des Moines at the Capitol around a variety of issues. Mm-hmm. And so he became quite the public face of the Klan in Iowa. And then recently there have been TV reports about him and his promoting of his group and talking about the expansion of his group. We have seen through a variety of affiliations with other white supremacist groups an increase of Klan involvement, and that's been in Iowa and in the Midwest and also around the country. I kind of pay attention to Nebraska, Iowa, and Kansas, and we've seen more activity in the Iowa area than in the Nebraska area.
Imperial Wizard Douglas Sadler is known as the leader of Iowa's Klan revival. Tell us more about him. He moved from Florida to Charles City.
What I know about him is pretty much what he's been able to share publicly, is that he was in Florida and he was part of the Klan community in Florida. Came to Iowa, I think, around 2000 and started up his activities then. He claims to be very much a part of the Klan family, dating back to his teens. And I would say in the past 2 years, he's really started to demonstrate in Iowa that he's the leader of this group.
What sorts of things is he demonstrating for?
He opposed the gay marriage issues in 2006 and 2007 in Iowa, and really, you know, promoting the philosophy of, you know, the Klan, you know, creating a commitment to racial segregation and the typical stuff that we have seen of the white supremacist groups.
Now, when have you had some of these pamphlets in hand and had a look at them?
Yeah, I've had them faxed and sent to me. I don't have one in front of me, but I have seen them. Yeah, they're very basic, crude, you know, flyers.
What sorts of symbols are on them?
The classic Klan symbols, which actually, if you're not familiar with it, it's kind of a circle with a cross and a teardrop in it, mm-hmm. or a blood drop in the middle of it. We have been seeing more of those show up at demonstrations around whenever there's been a kind of an anti-immigration rally. We've seen people with hats and shirts and pins on with the Klan symbols.
Any swastikas?
I have not seen swastikas from the Klan folks. We have seen the swastikas from the National Socialist Movement, and they are a group that has historically had an allegiance with the Klan. Mm-hmm. It's the NSM, the National Socialist Movement, has also grown in numbers and in their activity over the past several years, and oftentimes they draw upon each other to help support them in their demonstrations and in their work.
So in these pamphlets that have been found in certain areas in central Iowa and shopping left on cars and so forth, they're calling for people to do what?
To come and learn more about the Klan and to join their activities.
Well, what are their activities?
Mostly they're recruiting. Some of their just their meetings.
Given that they're giving out contact information and perhaps an event, it would be fairly easy to go to an event. Has anybody at the ADL done that or on behalf of it, maybe undercover?
I have not done that myself, no.
Do you know of anyone who's been to a rally?
No, most of them. No, not. I have received information from people who have gone to an event and have seen people with the the Klan symbols on them, but they've not been there on an investigation level. It's mostly just passing by and have seen them.
Mm-hmm. How many people do you think we're talking about involved in this resurgence in Iowa?
I don't know. Going by the count that Douglas Sadler has shared, he claims that there are about 11 of his groups in Iowa, maybe 50, 60 people. I couldn't really give you an exact number.
Mm-hmm. And you touched on this, gay marriage being one of the points. What are all the reasons that are coming together, perhaps making this fertile soil for...
Well, I think there are a variety of issues that are making it fertile. One, we have a sense of discomfort in the way things are being done on a governmental level in America. And so you've seen an increase of activity by right-wing extremist groups and also, some right-of-center groups. And the white supremacist groups really use that as a way of convincing people that their path is the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what specifically at a governmental level? That's pretty vague. What specifics?
Well, I would go back to a report that we've talked about where there's been a sense of anti-government conspiracy theories that have been developed. There's been an increase of militia activity. We've seen more involvement around the healthcare issue, immigration issues, the tax issues. So most of the larger pieces that we're dealing with on a daily basis within just society in general, and that there's been an increase of outrage towards the government from those groups that aren't in favor of how things are being done in America. During the campaigning for the presidency, we saw an increase of stuff on the internet making reference to President Obama, then candidate Obama, which carried over after he was elected into the birther movement, and then you have talk show hosts challenging his citizenship, and that fuels that energy within these groups.
Mm-hmm.
There was also an interesting situation that took place in Iowa late last year with a situation where there was a training that the Iowa National Guard was going to be doing, and it got picked up by some of the white supremacist, anti-government groups that the Iowa National Guard was going to start gathering people's guns and so on. So you have a movement of people that were creating conspiracy theories that the Obama administration was going to get rid of the gun rights. And so, you have another issue on the right that is fueling this energy.
I don't want to insinuate anything, but I do want to ask this question, especially based on some of the characteristics that you've just mentioned. This resurgence is coinciding with the rise of the Tea Party nationwide. Do you see any connection or mere coincidence?
There have been some individuals that have straddled both groups. So we have seen, I would guess, in the Tea Party movement that you have people on the extreme side that are looking for a way to join with a more mainstream group. I haven't really studied the Tea Party movement because it's pretty young and pretty vibrant at this point, but there are, the blendings of the grassroots activists.
Mm-hmm. It just seems at first glance, and correct me if I'm wrong, that both of them are drawing on some of the same frustrations, angers, the anti-government sentiment certainly there, taxation being, I think, in the Klan's view, illegitimate, correct?
Right. Well, you know, part of their slogans are that Obama has stolen, you know, the country from Americans, you know, the true Americans, as they would put it. And so we're very opposed to that kind of language.
Some listening may be very surprised to hear this, that there are hatred against non-Christian, non-white people in the state of Iowa. Are we somehow blind to this? Do you run into the attitude of just disbelief?
Yeah, I think some people aren't paying attention to what's going on around them. There's been a sense of Holocaust denial that has taken place in these groups. You have the anti-immigration movement that is pretty significant. And so people are, you know, constantly scapegoating other people. And I think that's taking place all over the country, not just in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Where does Iowa fit in on the spectrum when we look at the Klan and other neo-Nazi groups? Is Iowa in the middle or?
In the Midwest, it's not one of the major centers of it, but it's there. I would say it's stronger in Iowa than in other parts of the Midwest, but it's clearly not one of the leading states in this type of activity.
Mm-hmm. What does Iowa being alone in the Midwest as a state permitting gay marriage, does that perhaps make it a bigger target?
I think it does. I think that's where we saw several of the demonstrations by Douglas Sadler and his group, and then the National Socialist Movement and several other groups protesting that. There are other groups that have kind of surfaced in Iowa that we haven't seen so much in other places. One, Supreme White Alliance, is a group that I believe is taking root in Iowa. Not clear on the numbers. And then in the Midwest, another group called Volksfront that just had a conference in Chicago not too long ago. So there is more activity taking place.
What is the vision that these people have for America? If they had their way, how would they want to change American society?
Well, my initial response would be they would like to see it go to a historic place of America being, in their mind, a white country, and that less government in their eyes, and much more freedom for their philosophy of white supremacy.
They must be disturbed. It wasn't too long ago that the Census Bureau predicted that in just over 30 years, whites in the U.S. will no longer be in the majority.
I think that that's part of their rally cry, is that they're looking at that. And if you look in other states like in Arizona and in parts of Texas, some of these groups are really taking root over that information.
Where do you find the Klan has taken root in Iowa or is trying to take root? What cities, what communities?
Well, we know, you know, Sadler has mentioned his hometown of Charles City. We're seeing stuff in Waterloo and Cedar Rapids area.
When you say we're seeing things, what things?
Mostly from news reports and comments from or information from citizens in the area that have experienced things. Mostly, again, it has been the scene of activity around people wearing the symbols or, again, the flyers and so on. Mm-hmm. I've not seen anything other than that. I know that there was an article in one of the Iowa papers about some vandalism mm-hmm. that took place, and people were connecting it to the Klan. I don't have a full report on that.
Mm-hmm. If we wanted to open our eyes wider, make sure that we were not blind to this, what would we be looking for in our communities? Signs, symbols, clothing?
Well, you could go onto our website and see that we have a symbols database that shows some of the common symbols that the groups use. See the three Ks that are back-to-back and look like a triangle. That would be a common symbol. The numerical value of 311, even though that's a rock band, it's the 11th letter of the alphabet is K, so 3-11 stands for three Ks. So it's some simple symbols like that. And then again, always, you know, swastikas are always very common.
If you just joined us, my guest is Alan Potash. He is the regional director for the Anti-Defamation League. He's based in Omaha. The region he's in charge of covers the states of Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa. Describe the background of a person who might be very susceptible to the Klan's message.
Well, an individual who feels as though they're being threatened, that their rights are being violated, they are feeling a sense of alienation. Typically, we see young kids who come from backgrounds that aren't the most comfortable and are searching out like-minded people. And oftentimes they can find them. Now they can find them very easily on the internet, but they can also find them in small towns in America, where people have shared values of disliking other people.
Sounds like you're describing. We in our first half hour talked to Frank Mink, mm-hmm. And I know you know him.
Yeah,
and he's spoken on behalf of your league as well as a former neo-Nazi skinhead. So that fits into that profile.
Yeah, I mean, Frank's autobiography is a really good read into somebody and how they end up getting into that environment. And fortunately for him, he found a way out. There are all sorts of textbooks out there that talk about the profile of a skinhead or of a racist. There's a community out there ready to embrace that individual.
What can you tell us about the history of the KKK's activity in Iowa? When did it start? When was it at its peak?
I don't have a specific history of the Klan in Iowa. You know, it's a 140-year-old organization that has ebbed and flowed over the years. We pretty much, you know, saw it dissipate over the years. There's always been, you know, pockets of individuals that have belonged to a group, but have they grown in numbers? We just really started to see that increase in 2005, 2006. Whether they just were, you know, under the cover of darkness in a sense, or they really just, you know, disbanded. But it's been in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years that we've seen across the country an increase of this type of activity. And it could just be that, you know, the tenor of society is such that people feel that their lifestyle that they have grown accustomed to is being threatened.
How interested or concerned is the Anti-Defamation League in the unrest that we saw by some very unhappy people at the passage of the new health care bill?
Well, very much concerned about it, and we've commented on it. You know, when we start to see the debate go into violence, that's a problem for our society. But the piece that we're very concerned about is the level of rage that has grown around the political issues. And we've been seeing it for the past several years. It has just, I think, escalated. And when you see political figures not necessarily endorsing or promoting it, but not challenging it, it almost gives those on the fringes an opportunity to really rally their cause.
So what can we do, you, I, listeners, do to prevent the spread of the Klan and its message in Iowa?
Well, first of all, being strong citizens of your community and learning the issues of your local community and what are the challenges that the community has, and being able to address the disrespect that might come up at city council meetings, at rallies, when we see language being used that is offensive, to challenge that.
Not be a bystander.
Not to be a bystander, yep. That's a good way to put it, to stand up and, you know, realize that we have a responsibility to protect our communities from hatred and from, you know, offensive language and disrespect. So being able to learn what the issues are, be an advocate for civility and the civil rights of all people.
What if you suspect some Klan activity in your community? What should you do? Be that a pamphlet, you some kind of flyer you find on your windshield, or other things?
Well, in Iowa, you have quite a few opportunities. You can contact the human rights commissions of your community. You can always contact our offices and fill us and update us on what you discovered. If you've received a pamphlet or something in your driveway, in your mailbox, contact law enforcement. Let them know that you're experiencing this stuff. But Iowa has the Human Rights Commission. That's a great vehicle for addressing some of these issues.
Okay, very good. Alan Potash, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for contacting me. And we're a resource to learn more about these groups and situations.
Okay, very good. What's your website?
It's the 3Ws, ADL.org. O-R-G.
Alan Potash is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, based in Omaha. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange, available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.